Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by You Can Perform, Workout, Energize. That's GenerationYouCan.com, by VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, by Polar, Blood, Sweat, and Data, by our Challenge Athletes Foundation. We just sent out 3,260 grants totaling $4.8 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. You can help out at challengedathletes.org and check out any of our interviews on iTunes, on iHeart, or at Babbittville.com. And as always, endurance lives here. I always love athletes with really cool backgrounds. And Evan Pardy has not just a background as a professional triathlete, but he also plays the double bass in the Tucson Symphony Orchestra. Evan, how you doing?
I'm doing well, man. Just got back from a bike ride here in Phoenix, which might as well be considered a version of a salt mine for the amount of salt that I'm still pulling out of my hair right now. You know, if I was in ancient Rome, they'd have a lot of interest in me right now.
Exactly. Hey, so Evan, where'd you grow up? And were you always an endurance guy, or were you more of a ball sport person?
I grew up in Huntsville, Alabama, of all places. My father was a civil servant for the Army. And he was from the Bay Area, and they sent him out to Huntsville, Alabama, and he spent 18 years there, and that's where I grew up. I was more of a ball kid for sure. I played a lot of golf. Grew up from an Italian family, so you know it was kind of like golf was like the cool thing that, you know, my grandfather really idolized, like Palmer and all these sorts of guys.
Yeah.
And, of course, he wanted us to do boxing, which my mother was not as fond of as getting the two boys to go beat the brains out of each other in the backyard. But, you know, that is the Italian way. But I did a lot of golf, and I did this typical baseball, basketball sort of stuff. So, really, no, I was not endurance at all. I was always typically the bigger kid.
So when did this endurance world become part of yours?
You know, I actually got into it a little different way. I had a friend whose sister was a rower, and so they had some summer camp, and I've always been obsessed with like maritime history and naval stuff. Huh. And I was like, oh, rowing, you know, that's like, I don't know, one quarter sailing or something in my peanut 14-year-old brain. So we went down to the river, did this camp, and I, you know, got a boat, learned the basics, and then they made us, you know, row and race each other, and it hurt like crazy, right? Because it's rowing.
Right.
And,
it's brutal.
It's brutal, right? It's awful. And I remember like almost throwing up and all these things. And I like remember getting out of the boat thinking, that was amazing. That was awesome. I got to do that again. So I got into that for a little bit. I decided to run a little track, but I wasn't very fast. The local high school coach came down to a track meet and saw me and another kid race. The other kid did really well. I did really poorly, but he mixed up the names.
No
so he
way.
Sent me a letter.
Wait. He thought you were the fast kid and thought the other guy was you.
Yeah, the other kid's name was Eric. I'm Evan.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, we got to have Evan, but he meant Eric. And so, anyways, they tried, you know, they sent the thing. They're like, oh, yeah, come do cross country. And I was like, oh, well, they must have heard about my rowing. And I was like, oh, yeah, sure. So I showed up and he was like, you ran that great 800 meters in eighth grade. And I'm like,
yeah, not really.
Sure.
Yeah, I did.
I did that.
Yeah, I love absolutely. That.
That's... E with four letters. That's my name. You got it right. Yeah. Anyway, so I did that and slowly transitioned over to cross country in high school. Had some setbacks. I had an eating disorder in high school that really hampered my career, and through that eating disorder,
did it have to do with running? Where you just felt like I've got to get skinnier. I've got to get skinnier.
Yeah, exactly. I was a bigger kid.
Yeah.
You know, and then the typical problems of high school on top of that, and then I was a bigger guy. It just got too far. I was great to have an awesome dietitian and my parents' support, and so it, you know, within a year and a half, I was kind of back on the right track. But then I had bad bones, as you would think, right? Like, you know, you're a 17-year-old guy, 16-year-old guy, you're running 50, 60 miles a week, and you're not really eating right still. And I got a hip fracture, so I couldn't run for a year and a half. I still have a piece of titanium through my hip. And then I got into triathlon that way because I couldn't run. So I was like, I don't know, I guess I'll go swim. And there was a guy who was named Mark, who was like an older high school athlete that I looked up to. He had done one of these crazy Ironman things. And I'm like, what the hell's that? That seems really stupid. I like it.
Let's go.
That looks really hard. That looks awful. I can't believe that guy was out there for like 11 hours doing this thing. I remember watching, he did Ironman Louisville. And I remember that was right when I was in this point where I couldn't run. And I remember watching him on the live tracker being like, that's insane. What a goal.
Yeah.
Wow. That's so cool. Like, it just totally, you know, inspired me. And had the surgery, had everything, got in the pool, and, you know, spent, you know, 3 months basically flopping across like some sort of beached whale trying not to drown. And then I started doing tri. Never really got back into running after that, like pure running for, you know,
right
on the college track or anything like
so
that.
So were you always, in terms of the music part of your life, was that something the whole family was in the music, or was
absolutely not.
No, really?
No, man. Oh, I love my father to death. He is awesome. He's a funny guy.
Yeah.
I look up to him every day. But the man is tone deaf.
So how did
he try to sing along? And I'm like, you really created a great piece of 21st century art music there by singing completely out of key with that. And my mom, you know, she too, she plays piano and stuff, but certainly not a musical background. I got into it in the classic way that, in, you know, that we're seeing less of nowadays, but I got into it through a public strings program through a music teacher in Huntsville, Alabama, who came along to class one day and showed a bunch of fourth graders the violin, the viola, and the cello. And he even lugged along this small little walrus of an instrument, the double bass, and said, you know, hey, you know, if you want to play one of these, absolutely, all you got to do is just say yes, and we'll take you for, I think it was 30 minutes every 2 or 3 days, and you get to learn the instrument, and I'll teach the class. And so I signed up for cello on a whim. I was like, oh, cello looks cool. Well, this kid I didn't like, and I remember this very vividly, also chose the cello right before I was going to pick it. And so out of panic, I'm like, oh, I don't want to sit next to this kid. I'll pick the bass. Ah, why not? Okay, bass. Sure.
That was it. That led the bass.
Yeah, that was the bass. And then the guy's like, The wonderful old music teacher is like, well, you know, it's a bigger instrument. Like, he had a car, and my parents always had Volkswagen vans. So I was like, yeah, we got a van, no problem. Well, we can huck that thing around anywhere. So I chose the double bass, and one thing led to another, and I enjoyed playing it. I enjoyed the challenge. It's huge, right? So it was hard. And I, being a bass player, you're always in demand, and I found that out from pretty much day number one, right? Like, everybody, there's a billion violinists in this world. There's not as many bass players. So yeah. I was quickly, like, sort of pulled into that orchestra scene from there.
Wow. And we talk about when you travel for triathlon, it's a pain in the butt, right? Because you've got a bike and all that stuff. I can't imagine that you're traveling with a freaking double bass. Well, what do you do? How do you travel with this thing? Or do you have to ship it?
Well, there's a couple options. The best way is to travel with it because you want to keep eyes on it. For background, like, to give a kind of sense of like what these things are worth. And
I was going to say, what do they cost?
Important they are. When I was in a sophomore in college, my awesome bass professor at the University of Oregon said, hey, you know, if you're looking to, you know, go pro and play and do these things, you need a good bass. And it's like, great, you know, what should you spend? And he said about $40,000. And that's kind of the, like,
wow,
realm of that's going to get you a good bass. Now, there's a lot of options from that and so forth. But if you go to your symphony, say here in the Phoenix Symphony, we got a great section, a lot of great guys I've had the chance to play with. And, you know, most of the basses there are ranging in value from 55,000 to about 120,000, 130,000. They're old instruments too.
Yeah.
Mine is a newer instrument made by somebody in Oregon. I helped, like, I had input to the whole process, and he did a great job. And it's appraised at about 33,000, 34,000. So, and it's my baby. I love that bass. You know, it's
right.
It's my heart and soul. So I flew it. So I played in England. I played in an orchestra there. I studied. I left the University of Oregon briefly to go to England to study in this program at the University of Bristol. I got to play a solo with an orchestra and all this stuff. So to get the bass, like you say, to England.
Oh my God.
A logistic nightmare. So called basically every airline under the sun. Most of them tell you no pretty quickly when you say, well, I've got this case.
How big is it, and what does this thing weigh? Give me some dimensions of this thing.
The bass is about 6 feet tall, weighs about 27 pounds because it's hollow, and it's about three feet wide. And it's about 6'1", 6'2". I have a thing that makes my lower string lower.
Yeah.
So it sticks up off the top. And so then the case is huge because the case has to protect it with these
right.
airbag systems and all this. And the bass essentially suspends itself in the case using the system of airbags and like levers and all these things. And so the case is probably a little over seven feet, seven and a half, and about 4.5 feet wide. And it is heavy. Let me tell you, it's about 75 pounds, but that's still like over that size is really awkward. So trust me. So when I first got to England, I'll tell you a funny story.
Yeah.
I had this bass in this case. And I didn't have the little soft case because the soft case, you stick this little wheel in the bottom of it and you can wheel it around. You look like a ding dong, but you're still wheeling this giant little bass thing all over the place. Super easy, fun, no problem. But I had this case, man. I had this 75-pound case, 7.5 feet tall. And the flat that the university had put me up in was right downtown, right on the street of all these pubs. And this course is England, so it's cobblestone.
Oh.
And it's beautiful. I love it. It's great. You're like, this is awesome. But it's really, really not awesome when it's like 9 o'clock on a Friday and everybody's out at the pubs and you just had a rehearsal and you're like, I just want to go home. I've got to bring this massive thing. And I'm going down the cobbles, just bam, 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 the whole bass like bouncing all over the place. And of course, everybody has to get in the joke. Oi, mate, don't you wish you played flute? They're like, thank you. Yes, yes sir. Never heard that one before. Oh, we got ourselves a right royal babe, Bill Bailey over here.
Harmonica would be good at this point. Yeah.
Harmonica. Yeah, exactly. But one time I was wheeling this bass down Sunday afternoon in January, and I'm banging along the cobblestones. And of course, everybody looks at you. And it's kind of fun the first time. And the second time, and then the 20th time I'm doing this, I'm like, this isn't so fun. I don't like this. Yeah, and of course, I'm the one American really around Bristol because it's kind of out of the way from London. So you definitely stick out like a sore thumb with my accent. You know, hey, dude, it doesn't fit in very well there, right? But I'm going about my street, and it's all blocked off. I'm like, well, what's this? What's going on? I just want to go home, people. I've been playing all day. And it's Benedict Cumberbatch and Sherlock. Was filming an episode of that TV show, Sherlock, right, on my block. And I balance this double bass all the way up, and I say, I got to get through. I live there. I need to go home. And the guy's like, are you kidding me? Are you going to bring that through? I'm like, yeah, I got to bring this through. So the entire filming of Sherlock stops so I can wheel my bass bouncing down cobblestones right through the middle of it, this massive thing. So my like small claim to fame is Benedict Cumberbatch has looked very confused at me for about 10 minutes as I messed up their filming for a large TV show.
Oh my God, that is so wild. So talk a little bit about going from, okay, I'm doing triathlon, I'm swimming because my hip is messed up, I can't run, uh-huh. And that then you pick up a bike as well?
Yeah, I funded my bike. Purchase my first bike purchase through playing an opera. I was playing an opera when I was that year 17, and I played the run around Christmas time, and I was picking up gigs, playing Christmas gigs, which is like kind of the time of year we all get our gigs to pay for the rest of the year.
Yeah, pay for all your vacations.
Yeah, exactly. And so I, at 17, bought my bike through funding it with the gigs and stuff. So, yeah, I went down to the local shop and was like, yeah, I buy that, basic, simple road bike, and basically just started riding around rural Alabama, trying not to get hit by cars on the non-existent shoulders and things like that. So, yeah, I rolled along nicely.
Now, and when did you decide to – now, at this point, had you done a triathlon?
No, I hadn't. I hadn't done a tri at all. I spent almost 10 months kind of like prepping for my first one because I couldn't run at all. Literally zero running after the surgery. So I swam and biked as much as I could. And my senior year of high school, I did my first like local sprint try.
And you loved it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The first moment, it was pure love. I mean, I for me too, I would say one of the things that hooked me that I don't necessarily hear a lot of people always say is I love the logistics and I loved all the little problems that it created. Like I liked the issues of transition. I liked like all of the little semantic details. I like details and I like working hard on those things. So I really enjoyed all of the elements of how complicated it was, because it did, pulling a music analogy, it's like that music, I go play a gig and you get a piece of music in front of you and there's a billion details on that page and the notes don't always tell you how to play. You have to understand the style that it was composed in, who wrote it, when it was written, all these like unsaid things. And the same with triathlon, you have all these moving parts that have to be done. And I just loved that whole process. It was very much a love for the process.
And becoming a pro, when did you do that?
I earned my pro card last year, actually. And I raced my first pro race last December at Indian Wells.
So logistics, when you talk about, well, even Indian Wells, you got two transitions there. You were just ninth at the Herbalife Triathlon in L.A. And
yeah. In
that one, you got two transitions. You're riding across the city of Los Angeles. Yeah, there's a lot of logistics. I guess you sort of like those races.
I do. Yeah, I really like the point to point. Absolutely. And I say Herbalife was a great – that the Los Angeles Triathlon was just an awesome event.
It really was, yeah.
I cannot wait to get back there. Yeah, and that brings me to where I'm doing most of the rest of the year is Xterra, where my natural progression fell in mountain biking, where you have, the trail is an infinite number of of problems, an infinite number of successes, an infinite number of possibilities, and that sort of like realm of generation I really enjoy.
So, yeah, and it was 2017, you won Xterra Laguna Beach, you won Xterra Rockhopper. So you're one of those rare guys. You're doing Xterra, which is off-road triathlon. You're doing on-road triathlon, where you've gone, like 405 for 70.3 PR, third at the New York City Tri last year. So the variety, you like the variety, I'm guessing. You like the road, the mountains, everything. Every week could be a little different.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that. And I was in Oregon. I did cyclocross. I still race some cyclocross on Tuesday nights. I really like variety. To bring the music analogy again, it's one of the things as a player, as an academic, I study a vast plethora of musical traditions and styles. Of course, I focus on Western art music. I focused a lot on Baroque music. Then recently my dissertation's on a Swiss Jewish composer of the middle 20th century. And so, I think I pride myself academically on being very versatile and not getting stuck in a rut of being, I only research middle Beethoven symphonies and it's all I like and don't talk to me about anything else. I mean, I even wrote a large law paper on copyright issues and piracy before and submitted that recently. So, I really do like to constantly be challenging myself to do different things at all times.
I bet it makes it, because a lot of pro triathletes are, it's a struggle trying to get from race to race and make a living. And the variety that you have by being a professional musician, does it make the triathlon part just more of a compliment to what you do rather than, oh my God, it's the end all and I got to make a living here?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And it's sort of, I, you know, always sort of focus on what I can do now and today and what makes sense and being versatile and trying to move with the punches as opposed to trying to like craft this big overarching career, and panic about that. Cause you know, in music, you never know when that next gig's going to come, really.
Right.
So you have to be able to do that. And if you can't, and so many of my great colleagues who I adore and who are such good players aren't able to be flexible and to roll with the punches and allow their, you know, natural career path to take its career path. And they, you know, it's, if I'm not in the New York Philharmonic by 24, I'm done. And then instead of letting another opportunity come up somewhere else, they wash out. And I don't want to be that in try, and I don't want to be that in music.
So with you're part of the Tucson Symphony Orchestra.
I sub down there. I'm not actually a full-time player, but I played a ton of concerts there last year.
And then Broadway Theater, right?
Yep, play a lot in Arizona Broadway Theater.
You love that. And then you're doing, you've been a soloist and recitals in Tempe and Eugene and Bristol and the UK. What do you prefer? What's your favorite?
I'm an orchestra musician through and through. I am definitely a...
You like being part of a team.
I do. Yeah. And the orchestra is a great team. I think for me, triathlon-wise, I love being like a solo guy. You know, I train 98% by myself. But for music making and that expressive side, the artistic side, I love the joint product creation. And on top of that, too, I really enjoy like being a freelance musician. I play in so many different ensembles with so many different people. And, you know, for instance, I like I say, I play in Tucson Symphony an absolute ton, but I've also gone down and played in jazz combos for people on like the drop of a dime. And it's just a great to be able to transition from like that orchestra scene. One minute we're doing, you know, Richard Strauss's Also Sprach Zarathustra. And then the next weekend it's like jazz standards and just outdoors at like a wedding.
That's
you know,
so cool.
I enjoy that.
So what's been the, when you look back at that part of your career as a musician, what was the best gig, the coolest gig you ever played?
Ooh, great question. I think that's always a hard one for musicians. I had a great conductor once, Gerald Schwartz, who conducted the Seattle Symphony until he retired. I did a festival where he was our conductor, and he once said in his like really aggressive Italian, you have five concerts, that's it. Five great concerts in your life, and the rest never will be bellissimo, never. But I don't know if I've had all my five. I definitely have to say one of them is I did Richard Strauss's Ein Heldenleben, which is A Hero's Life. It's sort of this like really long piece of music about Strauss's like whole life. It's kind of egotistical, but it's a great piece of music. I did that with the Phoenix Symphony this March. And it was just spectacular. The music's obviously extremely difficult. I've been playing the excerpt my 10 years of my life practicing. And I finally got to do them all on that weekend. And it was absolutely wonderful. I'll remember that for the rest of my life. So that one for sure, I think right now I'd have to say that.
How much, in terms of your day, you got a mountain bike, you got a road bike, you got swim, you got run, you got the double bass. How does your day break down? I mean, how many hours are you practicing a day in all of that stuff?
Yeah, great question. And it sort of depends, again, what's going on. I'm a doctoral student in music at Arizona State University. So I also have commitments to rehearsals with the ASU Orchestra and whatever other stuff I might be in. So I would say a typical day during the school year, I wake up, get a run in the morning, go down to the hall, practice 90 minutes or so, eat lunch, and then I usually get a little more practicing in, and then I go to orchestra for about 2 hours, a little more. We do our typical daily rehearsal, at ASU. Then I hit the pool or bike, and then I usually try to be done around five, kind of running myself like a you know, 9 to 5, 8 to 5 business, so to speak. And of course, then I have to, you know, a lot of times I have rehearsals for other gigs, my jobs at night. Most of the regional orchestras and groups rehearse at night. And so if I have a gig that week, I go to rehearsal that evening and then kind of repeat. Some days I don't have class. I will do like a longer bike ride, usually Thursdays. And then as a doctoral student, I have a little more flexibility. Our classes are typically really small. There's only like 8 people in them. So a lot of times they're at night because they know the doctoral students have to play so much during the day and they got other commitments. So we all get together at night, and I usually do like a 3-hour, 3.5-hour night class once a week. But yeah. And again, like I say, versatility, try to be, you know, if there's a huge orchestra rehearsal day and I've had these where we have 8 hours of rehearsal and I have to be all over the valley from ASU to downtown and maybe ending the night over in Arizona Broadway Theater and not getting back to 1, I have to kind of adjust the realities of my training around that. And luckily I'm blessed because I have Tim Crowley, who coached, you know, Jared in 08 in Beijing as my coach. And he's just a freaking guru about being able to, you know, life periodization. If he's got
right.
a, you know, yeah, crazy
yeah, yeah.
week, he can craft something around that and I'm good to go. But yeah, that's kind of a look at my daily life. There's, you know, try to get 3 hours of practicing in a day, 2.5 or so of training, and then the rest being orchestra rehearsals. And again, you never know. It's like if we're doing something huge at ASU and then I have an opera that night, it's there's going to be a lot of plan.
I was going to say, you're one of those guys who sort of has, you know, your one job, your one life is night mm-hmm. times. And the other
right.
one, triathlon, is usually 5-6 in the morning, right? With either racing
yeah.
or early morning swim workouts. And, you know, so
mm-hmm.
I bet you don't see a lot of 8-hour sleep nights.
Yeah, I mean, I really try. You know, last year I did the New York City Triathlon, and then that next day at 4 in the morning flew back here.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kind of had a break all summer long because Arizona Broadway Theater hired me on contract for a huge chunk of this summer run of Catch Me If You Can, which is a great musical. Super fun. But at the same time, it's like, got off a plane, we were moving to a different apartment that day, and then I had to go do 6 hours of rehearsal until like, you know, midnight. And then we started shows, and we have preview shows for the local TV stations, and then we have donor shows, and next thing you know, the next week I'm doing 10 shows.
Wow.
And I did that all summer, and you're down at that hall and you're playing 2 shows a day, afternoon, evening. And yeah, I mean, you get home at 12:30, don't get to bed till 1, and it's, of course, it's summer in Phoenix, so I'd go out for a run at, you know, 10, so it's already 103, and it's like, well, I just don't have a choice, right? I am not waking up for that 5 a.m. group ride. Like, I need to sleep. So, yeah, you nailed it on the head. That's why I do most of my training solo.
Yeah, everybody else is done.
Right.
Now,
I'm the one lunatic out yeah. here in the summer. You know, it's like 4 in the afternoon. You know, my fiance, bless her heart, she goes out, she runs at 4 in the afternoon here, like every day.
Oh.
115, and she's like, you know, yeah, you get used to it. I'm like, you know, you are a badass.
That's unbelievable. Now, when you're a musician, neighbors, you're like, okay, string boy, can you tune it down there a little bit? Or most of the time you're playing at rehearsal, but when you do play at home, are you, you know, in a house so you don't have to worry about the neighbors, or are the neighbors like pounding on the wall?
I'm in a little condo right off the Ironman Arizona course.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, one of the reasons I live here. I will say this about the double bass. If you know, folks haven't heard it, I highly recommend YouTubing it. If you look up my professor, Catalin Rotaru, Rotaru, playing the bass, I think it'll really be eye-opening to how it sounds. It's actually quite soft in person. I mean, it's so low, the bass frequencies are actually quite soft. So I've actually very rarely had complaints. Actually, here,
good.
I practice at home and literally never anybody has said anything to me. And I often practice at ASU because, as we've gone over, like, the logistic headache of flying with this thing. I mean, you can imagine it's still a pain to go drive with it.
Yes.
So I usually leave it down at the department. And a lot of it, ASU is awesome to have, you know, this massive school. So we have two excellent instruments made in Germany in the 70s that are these beautiful basses that I take with me. And I use one as a practice bass, and then I have my nice bass to play whatever gigs I need to play on. So it's sort of a two bass operation here.
So are you one of those guys, because of what you do, that you have your own tuxedo?
Oh, absolutely.
I knew it. I knew it. So you're a guy who 1 minute is in the tux and the next minute you're in a Speedo.
I have gone tux to Speedo more times than I would probably care to relate.
I was guessing that you might hold the world record for the number of times going from a tux to a Speedo. And I don't know how many triathletes actually own a tuxedo and have one in their closet. And I'm guessing you might have multiple.
I do. I think I'm at two right now. I'm getting married in a couple months, and I'm using that as an excuse to probably get a set of tails even.
Oh,
that's what we live in as musicians. The occasional gig you'll get for a gala function will be tails. So white bow tie, white vest, white tux shirt, tails, of course. And then you have the specific tails pants, which a lot of people don't know are different than tux pants, and that they come up slightly higher and they're a little bit tighter. They're supposed to be sort of this military style. As we always joke around, like, musicians are the only people who could be at the poverty line and have three tuxedos in the closet and two suits with them.
I think there's your poster. It's you in the white tails with your bike, right? And the bass.
Uh-huh.
Bike, bass, tux. That's your photo card that you need to take to events.
That's a good one. I'm gonna take you up on that.
Absolutely.
I mean,
no, that's your.
I can put the tuxedo on fast enough.
I know. I bet having a competition in terms of transition, and you having to put on your tux, I think would be pretty special. That would be.
That's pretty good. I did one time show up at my. I was pretty young. I was probably 21. I showed up and I played with the Eugene Symphony in Oregon.
Yep.
Which was a tough gig to get into like music scene business, which I'm sure most of your listeners will know about, which is a little interesting dive. Most orchestras rehearse what's called as per service. So you get paid the same for a concert as you get paid for a rehearsal. You show up and the first thing people ask is, say, how many services is this gig? It's 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And almost every orchestra really never will play a concert with more than five rehearsals is pretty good. So just think about that. Like a lot of times I'll play a gig where the musicians barely know each other. We'll come up, it'll be two services, three services. We have two rehearsals. We play a show and everybody's playing along like, you know, like you've known each other your whole life.
That's amazing.
So to step back from it. Sometimes you do these gigs and you're like, this is incredible. I one time played in England. We did this massive oratorio, which is sort of an unstaged opera. We had one rehearsal the day of the show. It's Mendelssohn's Elijah. That's a 3-hour show. We had a 2-hour rehearsal. And the guy's like, all right, might as well just hit the spots. We're good to go. And then I'm sitting there like, are you kidding me? I've never played this. I'm looking at like 75 pages of music.
Oh,
so we hit
God.
The spots.
Yeah.
2 hours comes, because it's a union gig. So 2 hours, boom, everybody's gone. Hit the pub. And I'm like, I'm nervous. I'm not going to have a drink. But all the other musicians are like 2-3 beers. I'm like, oh my Lord, this is going to be rough. So we go back, play the show. And it's like, as soon as you walk on stage, you're a different person.
Yeah.
You're there. You're smiling. You're happy. You're relaxed. You're going to play it. You're going to be great. But I my first service with the Eugene Symphony, speaking of all these of attire, a lot of times orchestras will give you massive guides of like, here's what our definition of a suit is, and here's our definition of a tuxedo, and everyone's like a little different. So I messed up in my nervousness, and I went to Eugene, and I brought a tie instead of a bow tie.
Oh.
And so I'm like, oh my gosh, no, first job here, like first stage, and I'm going to get a talking to from the manager, like, oh no. And so I was sitting next to my old bass professor at UO, and he's like, hey man, no worries. And like the chillest way, I'm sitting there like sweating. Like this is an outdoor concert. I'm just like, oh my God, no, Tyler, I'm so screwed. And he goes backstage, gets gaff tape, comes back, sits on stage when everybody's warming up. And in the course of 5 minutes, makes the most beautiful bow tie I've ever seen out of tape you could ever imagine. Turns around, oh, pops my collar up and tapes this little bow tie there. And he's like, man, it looks great. You look good. And I'm like, are you kidding me? This looks amazing. So I was saved by my first real, like, bigger orchestra gig like that, I was saved by a bow tie. Bow tie made of gaff tape.
That is so cool. Duct tape, man. That's always the cure-all, you know? Got to have
that. Apparently. Yeah, you're
so
I
was reading through one of your blogs, and the one that cracked me up was Alcatraz 2018, right? When you talk about that you like being able to deal with things that occur, pretty much everything occurred on that day, correct? I mean, you jumped, you basically landed on somebody off the boat. The water is freaking freezing. There's no buoys at all. They basically say head towards land. They drop you they drop you off at Alcatraz and say, find the beach. And so you were all over the place. And your heart rate out of the water was through the roof. But you go through all this stuff. You know, your heart rate is crazy. I couldn't get your wetsuit off because it sounds like your chip was over the wetsuit, which they asked you to do. And you're like, your transitions were ridiculous, but you loved it all.
I did. I did. I Alcatraz was a blast. I can't wait to. I hope to be able to win that pro race soon here. That race was. I mean, just if anybody hasn't done it, like you know, that's got to be one of the top of your bucket list. I mean, once you get out in that bay, it's just insane. I mean, as soon as you hit the water, and I had the misfortune, like you say, of jumping right on somebody, and then I got jumped on. So you're in that water, you're already freezing, your heart rate through the roof, and then there's like body parts everywhere. You're like, this isn't good. This isn't good. And as soon as you start swimming, it's like your eyes are right there. You can't see anything. You
Nothing.
See the skyline, and that's it. And you're like, oh my gosh. It's like, what was it? You know, you can't. What was it they said on the boat? I don't remember. Just swim, you know.
How are we supposed to do with the current? Because it's not like you're just going, I'm swimming towards shore. It's like, no, you got to take into account the current and make sure you're going the right way, because otherwise you're going to be way too far the wrong direction.
They say sight to the city, then sight to the old boat docks, and then sight to the end of Marina Green, and you'll nail it. Now, that's sort of the average advice. Now, I've worked so hard on my swimming. When I did that, I sort of that year, last, especially in 18, the current wasn't as strong. So I kind of ended up being way too far into the bay.
Right.
So it's kind of, if you're a strong swimmer, you definitely shouldn't do that. You sort of should start swimming right towards the boathouses on the other side of the Presidio, as opposed to going right towards downtown. And by the time I'd figured out that, oh, you ding dong, you swam away, I was like at that channel of boats, and I was like, ah, no. So then I had to cut this big zig right across back into the field. And so it was a real mess. But, you know, and that race was also special to me because my dad worked at Presidio San Francisco
for
many, many, many years. And that race takes place right near his old building. Of course, the Army used to, you know, actually use it as a base.
Yes, it did.
And so,
yeah.
It was a cool moment to like, just, he was super happy. Like, oh man, it's so awesome to see you at this race and doing well. And race at the Presidio was really cool. But I can't wait to get back to Alcatraz.
Love it. Hey, Evan, thanks for taking time, man. I love what you do. I just love the balance, the work-life balance, and the fact that everything you do, you're enthusiastic about, right? You love riding a mountain bike. You love riding a road bike. You love doing triathlons. And obviously, you love the double bass.
Yeah, I do. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right. Evan Pardy has been our guest again. We are brought to you by UCAN, Perform Workout Energize at GenerationUCAN.com, by VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, by Polar Blood, Sweat, and Data, by our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We just sent out 3,260 grants totaling $4.8 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport to help out. Go to challengeathletes.org, and you can check us out on iTunes, iHeart, or at babbittville.com. As always, endurance lives here.